tell this lady?
Yes.
All right, operator, we're ready to go ahead and start.
All right, sounds good. I'll join you on to the main conference room. You'll hear a short burst of music, and once I cut the music, that will be your cue to begin. Have a great conference.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. I'd like to go ahead and get started and welcome everyone. My name is Tom Wallace. I'm the Bureau Chief of Medicaid Program Finance here at the agency. And so this is our second of a series of nursing home prospective payment study meetings that we're holding. Welcome everyone here. I'm glad to see everyone here and everyone on the phone as well. As I said, this is the second of a series of them. The first one was back in June. As everyone recalls who attended that, in that meeting was kind of given more of an overview of our process and just talked about, you know, kind of the goals, you know, the goals that we have for this process moving forward and whatnot. This meeting here, when Navigant gives a presentation, you'll see that we have incorporated some data elements here. So we have data to show and talk about the specific data. You will not see anything individualized by facility. So no simulations or models have been run yet by Navigant. But just kind of show you overall what we're seeing in the data and kind of talk about that some. We'd like to let everyone know that this meeting, as a previous meeting, is being recorded. And the results of, the recording will be posted on our website in the next couple of business days after this. As you see, I asked the operator here, so we have an operator assistance call today. And then so as we go through this and we open it up for public comment, I will ask, you know, the operator to go ahead and ask for public comment on the phone and questions as we go through this process. For those of you who would like a copy of the materials, I think probably most of you are familiar with our website now, but they can be found out on our website. And just for those on the phone, you can go to the agency's website at aca.myflorida.com, and there will be a hyperlink titled Medicaid. So you click on that and scroll down. You'll see another hyperlink that's titled Nursing Home Prospective Payment System. Within that, you'll see a copy of our agenda and then the slideshow that Navigant will go through, and then there will be any additional meeting materials that we have is always going to be posted on that website. You can also see the previous public meetings information along with the audio from that meeting as well. For those of you who don't know, we have recently, within the past week, posted an options document. So Navigant had put together an options document just kind of laying out the options for the prospective payment system. So if you have not looked at it, you might want to take a look at that. We plan on incorporating that into the final report. So the final report that's due to the legislature January 1st of 2017, this will probably be one of the sections in that report.
And Tom, I would just add that options document pretty much summarizes most of the things we talked about at the last public meeting. So it's really a kind of a summary of the things we were looking at.
Okay. And then also just want to mention, you know, I did talk about last time that we are holding a series of governance committee meetings too. We had two of them. Our second one was this week as well. And that is a group of just agency management that meets to kind of talk with Navigant to talk about some decisions and really key points that Navigant really needs to move forward in this process. So we had our second one of those meetings earlier this week. And we have made there was a series of things that Navigant needed to know to start looking at it by individual facility basis or whatnot and what kind of to model. So in that governance committee meeting, we made some tentative decisions that we'll be moving forward with, and we'll talk about those and discuss those as they go through this presentation. The results of that governance committee meeting will be posted on our website as well. So you'll see those there. One other thing I was mentioning, just a little housekeeping deal. When you guys are wanting to make a public comment or then really questions as we move through this, please use a microphone. We have two microphones. We'll pass those around. So just wait till you get the microphone prior to making any of your comments. Appreciate that. And just let us know your name and then the organization you're with. We'd appreciate that as well. And those on the phone, if you could, when it's your opportunity to speak, please let us know who you're with and your name. So with that, I'll say, you know, I got some agency staff with me here. You know, I'm Tom Wallace. I'm the Bureau Chief Medicaid Program Finance. And then I have my nursing home staff who's sitting over here, and Lisa Smith. You'll see her name at the end of the slide presentation. Any contact, you know, you want to make any contact information, submit us any additional information, feel free to reach out to Lisa, myself as well, but then Lisa's there. And up here with me is Navigant. And I believe all these guys, for the most part, were with us at the last public meeting. And they're here now, and maybe it'd be helpful for those who were not here that they can just go and introduce themselves again, and then we can continue.
Sure, I'm Jim Pedersen. I'm a managing director with Navigant. I lead Navigant's government healthcare services payment transformation team, and I'm the engagement director for this project.
I'm Jay Violetta with Navigant, and I'm part of the LTSS team.
Hi, Malcolm Ferguson from Navigant. Part of the Navigant team that has worked with ACA for the rate setting on hospitals and now on to nursing homes.
I'm Scott Mackey with Navigant as well, and I'm on our long-term care team as well.
Okay, great. So with that, I think we can go ahead and begin with the PowerPoint presentation, and I'll turn it over to Jay.
I'll just go through the agenda real quick. So if you put the agenda up, Jay. Or whoever's controlling it. Yeah, thank you. All right, so thank you, everybody, for coming today. This is a high-level agenda for what we're going to try to go through today. We're going to start off. Scott, you're going to do a quick summary of the public comments that we received after the last meeting. And then we're going to, in section two, we're going to talk about the data analytics we've done so far. We've done a fair amount of analysis trying to understand what's driving the cost in the nursing facilities. And we're looking at that all in the context of what types of adjustments or what types of just adjustments do we need to be making to nursing facility rate components and that kind of a thing. And we're going to go through and cover what kind of questions we are trying to answer with the data. And then Mal will talk about how we built the data set, what kind of data we were looking at, those types of things. Then Jay Boulat's going to talk about some of these statistical analyses that we completed and the nursing facility cost drivers that we've seen in the data so far. And then finally, in section three, we're going to spend some time going through a draft of the policy decision list, which will describe the decisions we're trying to answer with these analytics and whatever types of preliminary decisions we've made as part of the governance committee so far. And there aren't many of those yet, but we kind of look at that as kind of a running document that we'll be sharing with people as the project unfolds. And then, so we'll be looking at the policy decision list, and we're also going to be talking about some of the quality metrics that we're looking at to potentially incorporate a quality incentive of some type into the new payment model. So, and Jay's going to cover that. So with that, I'll hand it over to Scott to go through the public comments from the last meeting. Scott?
Okay, yeah, so we just wanted to start off with a brief summary of the comments, both from our early stakeholder engagements as well as our June public meeting. So to start off, some overall goals that were mentioned to us, something we heard a lot was we wanted to minimize winners and losers after this system is implemented. And then another thing that we really heard was that we want to really stress predictability and transparency. And then we heard a lot of comments about the acuity-based system, and a general consensus was that an acuity-based system would work as long as Florida's their staffing levels are accounted for. And some other comments we heard was combining some of the cost components if an acuity-based system is implemented. And then once we moved to the implementation timeframe, pretty much everybody wanted some kind of phase-in transition. The amount of years varied, but a phase-in sounded like it was something positive for everyone. And then moving on to quality measures, this is where we heard a lot of different varying opinions, not only on the different quality metrics that would be used, but how to weight those metrics and which ones specifically to use. And another thing that was really mentioned was not only to keep just to kind of have these thresholds, they really wanted to stress that improvement by facility was going to be used. And then another thing that was under contention was how much of the budget would be used or offset to be used for this quality incentive. And it kind of ranged anywhere from 3% all the way to 10%. And moving on to FRVS, that was generally liked throughout the providers. And then for the varying adjustments that could be used for rates, we heard a lot about geographics, facility size, and then kind of moving on to different acuity-based, like dementia or Medicaid utilization or occupancy.
Okay, so the public comments are all summarized in the PowerPoint. So, folks, we'd encourage you to take a look at those. And for those of you that were at the meeting, they should look familiar. If you weren't, that'll give you a good feel for what kind of comments we were hearing during the meeting. And again, we're going to have a time today to go through a new public comments from folks. So we'll be saving time for that as well. So, with that, let's go on to the data analysis. So we'll start off by just talking real quickly about what kind of questions we are trying to answer with the data or the data analysis that we were doing. And what we were trying to do was identify what measurable nursing facility characteristics should we consider in the rate setting process. And the key things we looked at, and you can get this down to really almost an infinite level of detail, but what we were really looking for were, do we need to make adjustments for differences in resident acuity? And we measured that with some RUGS information, and we're going to share the results of that with you today. Do we need to make adjustments for relative efficiency? And we think that while efficiency is a really hard thing to kind of get your head around, that may be more of a judgmental decision rather than a data-driven decision, but that's a question we need to answer. Should we make adjustments for facility location, regional differences, those types of things? Should we make adjustments for facility occupancy, understanding that facilities with higher occupancy tend to have a little bit lower per-day costs? Do we need to make adjustments for average Medicaid utilization? In other words, do we need to recognize those facilities that make a commitment to taking on a significant proportion of Medicaid residents for the state? Do we need to look at the size of the facility based on the number of beds? Do we need to look at the age of the facility? Do we need to look at differences in quality? And I think we believe that we do need to look at differences in quality. The big question is, how do we measure that and how do we adjust for it? So those are the key questions we're trying to answer. And there are a number of ways to try to adjust for these things. There are really are multiple ways, and I think what we need to do first is spend time figuring out what we want to adjust for, and then we're going to come back to how do we adjust for those things. In terms of the data that we're looking at, and Mal and Jay are going to talk a little bit about this, but when we're in the analysis that we've done so far, we primarily focused on looking at the minimum data set information, and in some sense we're converting that to RUGS data as well to help us to help inform the question about acuity. But we're also looking at that to try to extract some elements for measuring relative differences in quality of care and those types of things as well. We also have compiled a comprehensive data set that includes all the nursing facility cost report data, and we're using that data as well. And then for the quality measurement side, as I mentioned, we're looking at the MDS data, and we're also looking at OSCAR and other survey data that's publicly available, including some of the published quality measures that are out there, the gold seal, the five star, those types of things. We're looking at those as well. So those are that's what we're trying to do with the data. I'm going to pass it off to Mal here to talk about how we have actually adjusted or how we've actually built the data sets to do the analysis, and then Jay's going to follow up with what the analytics look like and what the results are.
Okay, thanks, Jim. We're good. So we, as Jim mentioned and Tom mentioned, you know, we've done some data analysis, and obviously we'll continue to do more. In the interest of having this an open process, we wanted to explain what our data looks like so far and the steps we've gone through so far. For the non-data people here, I apologize, this is a little dry, but I've already met a few heavy data people in this group, so I know there's some that will be interested. And in a second purpose for doing this is, if anything, for those of you who are strongly familiar with the nursing home data in Florida, if anything looks funny to you, the numbers or totals or any portion of it, then we'd love to talk to you afterwards just to make sure we're capturing everything correctly. But the first thing we're going to talk about, well, first of all, the data sources that we used are MDS data that we were able to get from the state, also a copy of cost reports that are in a rate-setting database that ACA maintains to use for setting your rates today. Those have been the two primary sources, at least so far. Then we'll go into more detail about quality sources that we're looking at. For the MDS data in particular, one of the tasks we wanted to do was identify who in the set of data is a Medicaid recipient. And as any data person would know, data isn't perfectly clean. So we took a couple of different attempts to get there.
Am I cutting out a little?
Okay. The first that there is a field called Medicaid recipient ID on MDS data, and we gave the users benefit of the doubt. If they put in anything, a numerical number that was at least 8 characters long, we counted that as a Medicaid ID. In truth, Medicaid IDs here for recipients are 10 digits, but we figured if they got to 8, they probably were talking about someone in Medicaid. In addition, there is an option in this particular field, which is a plus sign that says Medicaid ID is pending, that we're working on getting the Medicaid ID. So we assume those were Medicaid recipients. The next step we did was to pull a recipient file with the help of ACA, an eligibility file, and then added in anyone that did not appear to have a good Medicaid ID in their MDS record. If the assessment date matched the Medicaid eligibility record, we assumed they were a Medicaid recipient. So the result of all that was 44% of the recipients in the data set are Medicaid recipients, and 79% of the total days are for Medicaid recipients.
Go ahead.
So this next chart, I won't go through this in detail, but this next chart tries to summarize all of these numbers and what did it look like. We can talk a little bit more about the whole data set here. The MDS data, again, what we pulled was one record per recipient. We pulled their last MDS record that we found within the date range of the most recent cost report that ACA has on file for each nursing home. So the end result is 242,000 records. That's including, again, both Medicaid and non-Medicaid residents. And it is from a 12-month period.
Go ahead.
We then went through, we have a couple of charts here just to kind of look at the data and summarize it and see if we can get a feel that it feels accurate. One of the things we did is looked at what assessment types ended up in our data. For those who are familiar with this kind of data, there are some assessment types that will not result in a RUG grouping, and we wanted to assign RUG codes to all of these records. So anything that would not result in a RUG grouping, we took out. And this shows us what is left, the set of assessment types that are in the data. And for those who are familiar with it, there are two assessment types, one for the Medicare PPS and another one for OBRA. So for what it's worth, we have shown you the types of all the various different types and the counts that ended up in our final data set.
What else you got?
Okay. Another table here just to kind of make sure we're comfortable that the data feels accurate was we looked at case mix using RUG grouping for the data in the data set. We used RUG 4 codes, and we used the 48 code set. And then we just looked at the case mix index or average relative weights for all of those codes, and we expect that the Medicaid population would have a lower case mix, and looking at the data, in fact, that's the way it turns out. The Medicare residents who tend to be there shorter and for rehab would tend to have, on average, a higher case mix, and that's what the data shows. This chart is looking at who gets rehab services. In theory, if Medicaid residents generally get less rehab services, and these were identified here by the RUG code. So these are residents who got rehab RUG codes assigned in our grouping. If the number of Medicaid residents with RUG codes was very, very low, we could consider, is there some way that we should carve that out of the payment method? This number would suggest that it's not low, and I don't expect in any way that we would carve rehab services out of the payment method.
Yeah, go ahead.
And so Mal, just to clarify, and correct me if I'm wrong, but when we did this analysis, we used, just so folks that are familiar with how RUGs groups, we used the index maximization method for assigning these as opposed to the hierarchical method. So that rehabilitation classification, there are actually some rehab classifications that have lower case mix than some of the non-rehab classifications. So these were assigned based on the index maximization, which means for all of the classifications that you could be assigned to as a resident, you are assigned the one that had the highest relative value.
Go ahead, Jay. What do we got? And then again, a couple of these charts are somewhat curiosity type charts, but again, just trying to look at the data and get a feel is do we have an accurate data set here? We simply listed the top 20 RUG codes by volume from we use the Medicaid recipient volume number to identify our top 20 codes. And in this particular chart, we have them ordered by RUG relative weight, so the highest relative weight at the top. And again, this is just to kind of get a feel of what's in our data, what types of residents are being covered by Medicaid. One more quick summary here. This is by the different categories of RUG codes, right? There's six or seven different high-level categories of RUG codes. This just summarizes by those categories. This chart lists the per diems as they exist today, kind of summarized and grouped a little bit. And it sort of highlights the point that the cost-based, facility-specific rates that exist today have a reasonably large range of payment rates across facilities. So the agency arguably is paying different amounts for the same service, at least in some cases. From a policy point of view, this kind of chart would be the argument for maybe we should have a more standardized type of payment method. Okay. Then the next chart here we calculated the median cost for each of the three categories of costs that are other than property, the three categories of patient care costs that are currently incorporated into the per diem in the payment method. And we just calculated here by, I guess I would say, the newer categorization where we used all six categories. I believe most of it now is done by four categories, north, south, large, and small, and then the central is an average of the two. What we did here is calculate it where central is its own category and gets its own median. We certainly will be looking at least one option is to use these medians in some form, whether it's this set of categories or a new set of categories. We're likely to look at these median costs as a base in some form or another towards standardized rates. All right, now I'm going to turn over to Jay to the more interesting stuff.
Thank you, Mal. And I'm going to go into some of the data, but so just for the group, I guess for disclosure, part of our attempt was to determine whether the existing adjustments that were being made and looked at by ACA were appropriate to carry forward into a new funding model. And so a lot of that was the approach that we took initially with bringing together all the different data sets. And as Mal mentioned, we had quite a few different data sets that we were able to bring together and create what might be considered facility-specific measures based upon the MDS, the cost reports, the CMS quality measures, the Aspen data. So all that was brought in to create some larger measures for us to understand what was happening with the payments within long-term care. And I'll get into it. One of the ones we heard earlier on from the group is the issue with the high staffing levels and case mix. Would that work with the high staffing levels? And what the data actually showed us is it appears to be right now the high staffing levels are appropriate enough to adjust for the case mix that we have for each facility. So the relationship is, it took us quite a while because it wasn't in the direction that I don't think any of us expected. But because of the artificial introduction of that floor for staffing, the relationship is a negative relationship where as case mix goes up, the cost for the facility for that cost driver stays the same or actually goes down, but it actually stays the same because there's a floor there, which wasn't at all what we were expecting. We were expecting to see some linear relationship between case mix and staffing, but there's no incentives right now built within the system. And that's usually something you see once a state moves to case mix, that you'll start seeing those directions occur. Relative efficiency, those were some things that were talked about, and we included some measures within our model for relative efficiency. It does appear that for the total cost, now I'll talk about that in a second, what we looked at was total cost, not your per diems. So in the cost reports, we had the total cost, and that's what I looked at, so I had a really true understanding of what was happening across the state. What were the total costs of care, not what the per diem was, because that, again, has a cap to it as well. So for efficiency, for the facilities that were larger, more beds, had slightly lower costs, operating costs, and or total care costs. Let me frame it that way because that's what I'm going to focus in on. As the facilities got larger, and that's, to those of you who worked in long-term care a while, that's to some extent to be expected because you have your direct care, which is almost linearly related to the number of residents you have, but you also have your indirect care, which is where you really see your economies of scale, providing services across the facilities. Facility location was another one that was discussed quite a bit, and is there geographic variations? Now, Florida looked at north, central, and south, and I included some of those in the model for the facilities that were in there to look if there were geographical differences based on those really broad categories of north, central, and south. In fact, there were no differences to cost of care in central and north. The variation, the significant differences occurred for facilities operating in the south, and that there's a big area in the south. So I did do some additional analysis and was able to determine that the cost of doing business primarily in two different regions in the south is where it becomes significant, but it drives that whole variable because we have lots of facilities in there, but these two areas, it's the very southern tip, is what makes that region significant. We also looked at urban and rural. These are some adjustments that are made by lots of individuals, lots of entities to adjust for cost. And there is a small cost increase for doing business in an urban area versus a rural area. And then the facility occupancy, which is somewhat of a measure of efficiency as well. Also, and this is, let me make sure I'm on my same slides. Yeah, so occupancy also, the more occupied a nursing home is as far as a percentage, and that's the way I looked at the occupancy, resulted in slightly lower cost per day to deliver the care in those facilities, which was, and I'm going to tie in something that's not my data, but it was something that I found interesting because in the long-term care rate setting meeting yesterday, they are making adjustments because they're noticing that as facilities get slightly smaller, the cost of doing business increases. So it's the reverse, but it's actually exactly what it is we're seeing. As the occupancy increases, as the number of beds increases, you see those efficiencies occur. And so this is some of the, and I try putting in a format that may be more digestible, of the regression analysis. And remember, this is based on all those various data sets that I mentioned, the cost reports, MDS, the agency data that it has. And I don't want to go down the list. I'm going to look at total care, but if you have any questions at the end, we can go over each one of the components. The total care is simply a model that was run that includes the operating cost, the indirect care cost, and the direct care cost. And you can see across the board, case mix is associated with lower per day costs. So as case mix increases for a facility, the per day cost decreases. It doesn't really, but that's the way the regression model interprets it because of the floor that's there. Urban areas, again, for the total care cost, there was no difference, but the direct care costs contributed to about $4 per day to that cost for facilities operating in an urban area. The south was a significant area. That was the big cost driver, and again, I dove down into that much more deeply, but I broke it down to the 11 regions. And it's that very southern tip that drives that big geographic area. Medicaid utilization,
So the way you have to read this, and I converted it into something that's a little more digestible for folks to understand, but for each percentage increase in Medicaid utilization by a facility, it reduced the operating cost by about 65 cents per day. Occupancy, same thing, as by percentage points. For each percentage point increase in occupancy, reduced operating cost, or accounted for about 5 cents per day of that operating cost, relatively minor. As we've heard from other groups, and is no surprise for you all, the staffing is where the big cost drivers are, and to some extent this is really good because the model is capturing a lot of the variance and cost that we have with all the data. It has more variables in here, but there were more control variables that were included and weren't significant. Licensed nursing hours, for every hour increase adds about $52 per day for operating costs, and CNA hours about 16. Facility age also had an impact on the operating costs. So those of you operating really old facilities, you know your costs are a little bit higher. Whether it is because of newer technologies available in the newer facilities, the way they were designed, older facilities weren't really designed for efficiency. They were built off a hospital model. Newer facilities tend to operate a little more efficiently or to have a little bit lower care costs per day, total care costs per day.
So Jay, if I could just add a little context to this too. So just as you, as folks look at this and as you take this with you, if there's a value that shows up in the cell, that means that we believe that there was a significant statistical relationship. If it says none, we believe that it did not. And there's one cell up here for in the CNA hours per day where there's a little tilde in front of it. That just means we think it's there's a relationship, but it's not.
Very strong.
It's not very strong. So just so you know as a takeaway when you look at this stuff.
Yeah. Thanks. So also included in various models, we're looking at the impact of quality. So does quality cost money? Maybe not a way I would necessarily interpret it, but I was looking at facilities that have some of the more common measures that we're used to seeing, the five-star quality ratings, or breaking those down into subcomponents, the health inspection ratings that contribute to the five-star, the staffing rating that contributes to the five-star, and the RN staffing that contributes to the five-star. You can see, for the most part, the staffing rating, as CMS measures it, really doesn't contribute or have any relationship to cost, to the total cost per day, or even down the line to operating costs and direct care costs or direct care costs. What you do see an increase in five-star, as you move from a one-star to a two-star, two-star to a three-star, you do see some additional costs associated, so inspections. Intuitively, you probably know what that is. There's either you added a quality control manager to it, or there's something you did that assisted with that, because a measure here is good. The higher stars you have for your health inspections means you got lower health inspection scores. Same thing is true with staffing. And again, these are also related to some extent, the high staffing that we have in Florida, and the way CMS measures it, because we know that we score really well in Florida because of our staffing, and that's a component of the CMS five-star.
I think now that we're going to move to the next section, let's just kind of open it up and see if there's anyone here in the audience that has any questions so far.
Just a question on the...
If you can hang on a second and get a mic here, that'd be great. Right here, front.
Thank you. Question on the Medicaid percentage and the issue of acuity. So is the lower cost as the Medicaid percentage goes up an issue related to there is no private paying client making demands with market competition, or is it that the acuity levels are different between the high utilization Medicaids and the low utilization Medicaids? Is there any relationship there at all?
I don't think we have the appropriate data to be able to answer that question statistically.
I think that would be an interesting.
Yeah. And some of you will understand what this is, but the models that we created varied anywhere from 55% to 60% of the variance. So the R square was 0.55 to, depending on what variables we included, 0.6, almost 6.1, which is actually really good for a regression model for this. It means that we're capturing a good bit of the cost drivers, at least the factors that influence the total operating cost. It still means it's 40% or roughly 40%, maybe 35% that we don't know that's contributing to the cost. there's lots of different things that we don't have. I mean, if we had some really good data on the full operations of a facility, we could probably get that model up significantly higher than that. But even with that in place, I feel pretty confident in the model that we have in making some of these determinations. Now, if we introduce more variables, then we're still limited because we have an N of 658 is what we're operating with. It could affect the outcomes to some extent, and we have to worry about missing data because not everybody has really good data. But clearly, I think the researchers in us would love to have more data, but we operate with what we have. And what we have is actually, I think pretty significant as far as understanding what some of the drivers are and to influence some of the future decision-making, because the approach that I take is if we're going to make a decision, let it be an informed decision, not something that just feels like we ought to do it, but let's back it up somehow with the data that we have available.
But I think I would also add to that, what it's really just telling us is that, from an acuity perspective, is that there's just not a link between the way the national data, the national RUGs weightings match up to what we're seeing in Florida. That's all it's telling us. And does that mean that we shouldn't do an acuity adjustment or not? Maybe it's a good argument for not adjusting for acuity using RUGs. At the same time, it may be perfectly appropriate, not necessarily just for cost differences, but it may be perfectly appropriate to make adjustments for things like ventilator care, high behavioral needs, urinary, I don't know, whatever.
Behavioral.
Other types of things that may be more related to creating enough access for care as opposed to trying to adjust the cost to accommodate that, if that makes sense. Yeah, okay.
Just a question about your regression modeling. I'm sorry. I'm Irvin Bodo, representing Leading Gate Florida. A question about the regression modeling. In particular, I didn't have access to the case mix data. Mm-hmm. So what every analysis that I have looked at, some of the quality factors always came in number one or very close to number one in the regression analysis. What I'm reading from the data that you presented so far is that once case mix is introduced, then essentially drops
it controls out.
Is that your interpretation also?
Yes. So if we didn't introduce case mix, you would see it changes actually a fair number of variables, go from either significant to not significant or the other way around. So the case mix is controlling for a fair amount of the variance that we have in the model. And that's what I would contribute to the quality not being. Now, again, this is in the cost drivers. So sure. We're not trying to predict quality with this particular model. We could try to, but I don't think we have the appropriate data available right now to do that really well.
Okay, thank you.
Doug Burwith, Healthcare Navigator. Just a couple questions, and I can follow up on one of the comments there. I can follow up on one of the questions over there about the population in Florida relative to the national. I've looked at that a number of times, and it is true that the demographics of the nursing home patient population in Florida is significantly different to the national, and maybe it's a place that we ought to start is look at some of the demographics like age and comorbidities and percentage of dementia and some of the other population factors, because the commenter's absolutely right. We do have some significant variance between our population here in Florida and everybody else, not only in terms of Medicare utilization in the nursing home population, but also in terms of who makes up that population and the length of service within the nursing home community. So RUGs weights that were developed on a population base, primarily Maine, South Dakota, Kansas, those states aren't going to be applicable as much in the state of Florida. But one question I had was, when you were going through the total cost analysis and you found that South Florida had a significant difference to the rest of the state, did you make adjustments for related party transactions, or were you using, was it total allowable cost, or was it total cost reported kind of in the first column of the cost reports?
I will have to go back and check.
think total allowable, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was total allowable as well.
Okay, and then second question related to the MDS information. When I was looking at the breakdown of the types of MDS assessments you had, roughly 40 to 45% of your assessments were in a code 99. I'd like to understand a little bit more, exact, not being an MDS expert, what code 99 is. But the other question is, just under, I think, 60,000 of your 242,000 were admission assessments, which are most likely going to be Medicare assessments and short stay. Do you have any concerns that those patients and the point at which they are in their post-acute stay are painting a very apples-to-orange comparison relative to the long-stay population that we're trying to assess and paint a picture of here, and therefore the difference that you're showing of a 1.3 to a 1.12 in terms of the case mix is actually inflated simply because that you didn't choose to use a quarterly assessment for everybody?
So I'll tell you that we looked at case mix several different ways, and there's different reasons for that because of the introduction of the Medicare population. The model that I presented there included what we would consider a weighted case mix that adjusted for the number of residents in a facility who were Medicare versus the number of residents in a facility who were Medicaid. So it's a weighted case mix to adjust for a little bit of that. What was the rest of your question now? I'm trying to remember what code 99 was. I think it was an PPS.
Yeah.
There's a list and it varies by measure on what different codes CMS uses. They use pluses, they use minuses, they use 99s, they use lots of different symbols to capture pieces. And we could share that. It's pretty accessible,
if I may.
As far as the initial assessment question, though, what we tried to use was the most recent fell within the cost reporting period because we were trying to match up the MDS to the cost report data we were looking at. And if the initial assessment was the most recent one, that's what we ran with because there was nothing else to look at. So we were just trying to make sure we were capturing an assessment for everybody that was in the facility.
Perhaps going back and taking a look at that information without those assessments in there just to see what it would look like as well.
Yeah, and that's something we could certainly do. But then we wouldn't be capturing all the residents in the facility. So.
Yes, my name is Sheila. I'm with Summit Care. And 99, it means none of the above assessments.
That's right.
Whether or not you're using 99 under AO310A, which is for your OBRA assessments, or AO310B, which is your PPS assessments, it would be none of the above for the opposite one. But and also on those assessments, 06 under AO310B is a non-existent assessment. It was deleted quite a while ago. So I was kind of wondering how that would figure into the calculation as well. And the other question I have is regarding the RUG levels. It appears that maybe you have just assigned RUG levels to Medicaid residents that currently are non-existent. It's the RAA through RAE, I believe, and it looks like you've maybe assigned the last alphabetical character for the ADL indexes. So I was just wondering, are those RUG scores that you've just assigned?
No. So we use the CMS code to assign RUG scores.
Those are not CMS RUG scores.
We can certainly go back and look at it, but we did simply run the MDS records through the CMS grouper and took what came back. What, just so we can get it, what specifically was the code you thought did not look valid?
The codes that are not valid are RAA, RAB, RAC, RAD, and RAE.
Okay, thank you.
That's an all level, yeah. So we'll take a look at that.
We could take a look at that. To the extent that those need to be broken out into other categories, we can do that. But, you know, the explanatory effect of that, you know, I don't know that it's going to change what we're looking at. But we'll certainly go back and double-check that for you.
I'm Joe Mitchell with Summit Care, and I just wanted to point out, or at least ask that it be reviewed a little bit further. The Medicaid percentage typically is run about 60%. And I'm sure there's some other data folks in here that could explain that a little bit better. But I just know that's been really a pretty consistent number for some length of time, and most recently. So 79% seemed like it was a little high.
Yeah, we can at least look into that further. And is the 60% percent? Do you happen to know what measure that is? Cost, charges, people, days?
Census, days.
Days. Okay, thank you.
And actually, just one other follow-up comment. Doug had, I think, already asked it, but just on the question of what kind of costs were being used from the cost report, whether it was allowable or not allowable. And I just want to reemphasize that that would be extremely important, particularly in terms of getting apples-to-apples comparisons from one report to the other. Thank you.
Are there any other questions in the room? Okay. Operator, let's go to the phone line, if you don't mind, and see if there's any questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, to ask an audio question, please press star 1 on your phone, followed by the pound key. Please press star 1 to begin. There are no audio questions queued up at this time.
Okay, thank you. All right, so now we will go ahead and move into the next section, section 3.
Yeah, can you just flip to the next one, I think? QD and then just for delivery. Okay, so the next section here, we have two slides that we go through a list of what we call policy decisions. In list form, anyway, this sort of matches what's in that options document that Tom mentioned has recently been posted on the ACA website. And this is an effort on our part to organize our thoughts in terms of what are the decisions we need to make as we work with the governance committee and with folks in these types of public meetings. It's at least possible to have us add things to this list or certainly add options to the list. But anyway, this is our thought process so far. And we did have a governance committee meeting 2 days ago and have some tentative decisions on a couple of these. At this point, absolutely nothing is final. But anyway, we have a couple of at least thoughts of where we're leaning that we can offer in this meeting here. The first one is on the adjustment for acuity. As Jay mentioned, you know, we really were kind of coming in thinking that, yeah, it probably makes sense to do some sort of adjustment for acuity based on a RUG score. The cost factors and the regression that Jay ran sort of suggest that that really doesn't make a lot of sense, whether that's because the population is different in Florida or we think at the very least the high minimum staffing levels here don't give the nursing facilities the flexibility to change their staffing with acuity. And so an acuity adjustment doesn't feel like it makes sense right now. So we are leaning against that in terms of an adjustment to the per diem component. We've talked a little, and we'll talk some more about if there are needs to promote access to care for more complex patients, maybe we could put something in from that point of view, and maybe acuity would be a way to identify complex patients, but we're very early in our thinking on that process. The next one was, can we adjust for or should we adjust for any kind of specialized services or specialty services? Ventilator care comes up in most conversations we have as the classic example of where there is probably limited access and it's very, very expensive patients. Are there others, you know, and so that's at least a possibility for some sort of adjustment to per diems. Dementia has come up, obesity. So we're going to at least look at and consider some of those things to the extent that we can identify them through the data that we have. Next one is adjust for differences in quality. I think as a group we are leaning towards that, but there's a long way to go there in terms of deciding the logistics of it, how much money would go into a quality type of incentive, and how would we measure that quality. Those are difficult questions, and we're really kind of early in discussing those. Regional wage area differences or regional differences is another option that we've been looking at. We considered wage area as one option, but again, from Jay's analysis, what we've really kind of seen is that the only significant area that seems to have higher costs from what appear to be a wage type effect is the South Florida area in the Miami-Dade County, Broward County. So we don't, wage area seems like an unnecessary complexity from the numbers we're seeing. So we're considering other options. Maybe one option is to use the ACA regions as the 11 regions they've decided divided the state into as of now. 10 and 11 fit the area that seems to be high cost. So that's at least an option on the table where we're still thinking that through. Next one is adjustment for facility size. The per diems, as probably you all know now, do have an adjustment for facility size, just simply a large and small categorization, and the cutoff is 100 beds. So we're going to look at that. Maybe we'll change it, maybe we won't. If we were to change it, I think we'd have to see some data that would suggest a need to change it. But anyway, we will be looking at that. Another policy decision for us to do is what components will there be in the per diem? Today there are four components, direct, indirect, operating, and property or capital. Again, if we were to change these, I think we would need something, some motivation or something to show us that there's some value in changing these, maybe combining operating and indirect purely from a simplicity point of view, but still kind of early in the discussions on that. We don't see that as a huge factor at this point. The calculation of the property component, how are we going to go about doing that? We are leaning towards an FRVS type system, although everything is quite tentative at this point. So we'll be modeling some numbers. There seems to be some consensus among the industry that FRVS would be a little bit better than what is in existence today. One more is a transition period. I haven't gotten to that with the governance committee yet. But as Scott mentioned, there's been clear feedback from the industry that some sort of transition period into this new method would be beneficial. And again, here we're just listing the components of the per diem. Some of you may be very familiar with this, some may not, but this is the existing system as it works today. What are the cost centers that map into each of the four components of the per diem? And they really are. I would argue, Lisa, there's a couple more components to the per diem after this, like quality assessment and supplemental payments. But these are the four primary components and how they map today. All right. And now I'm going to turn it over to Jay to talk more about quality and specifically.
Yeah. Show them where I need to be. Again, this is to some extent a summary. Stakeholders across the industry have said quality needs to be a component, should be incorporated into the payment methodology. Lots of folks have expressed some concern, though, in using existing quality measures, specifically the 5-star. Does that really capture quality? Or is it, measuring something else that maybe we don't want to incentivize? There's a lot of new quality initiatives coming down the pipe, and that long-term care industry right now is being required to implement. CMS has added three more new quality measures to the long stay. I don't even know how many to the short stay. I haven't really paid as much attention to it. So facilities are already, to some extent, burdened with looking at all these different potential quality measures, whether they're CMS or Advancing Excellence initiatives. So try not to do anything new. Don't make us collect something different that we're not already collecting now. And then we heard from various groups some issues with the Florida Gold Seal. Gold Seal, some facilities, legal offices are telling them it's really not a good idea to pursue this because of potential backlash or litigation issues. And then for us and as an agency, where really want to identify some measures that would be that would capture outcomes that we want to see across the industry, the care of our residents. So we have outcome-oriented measures, which are the CMS measures and resident satisfaction quality measures that are happening. And then we have some options as far as process-oriented, which is might be classified as staff turnover, staff ratios, turnovers, survey performance, financial performance, and some of that goes into the current five Florida Gold Seal. Some states use a project-based grants-funded quality initiative and then some rebalancing initiatives. This is just for those of you who haven't seen it or are familiar with it. This is what the big omnibus data that we're using that informed some of the models from the CMS five-star. As you can see, we have a fair number of facilities who fall in the four- and five-star range, luckily a smaller number in the one-star area. But you can just see how it breaks down into the variables that feed into the overall quality, and that's the health inspection QM rating, staff rating, and RN. We provided for you, if you wanted it, you know, how CMS calculates the five stars and what goes into each one of these staff ratings, because I think everybody has this feeling based on some of the, you know, early research that's been done that staffing does have an influence on quality. That's what we'd like to believe. We spend a lot of money, a lot of initiatives on staff training, on retaining staff. I myself invested heavily in the Better Jobs, Better Care studies and the work that was done when I was in another state trying to promote quality jobs for residents for staff to improve quality of life for residents. Health inspections also has some interesting features that are part of it that we think may add some value to understanding quality without creating any new measures. This is stuff so the health inspection ratings, again, comes from a variety of different sources, but it's something that's already being done, that's already being fed either to the state or to CMS directly, that might be a source of information for us to build quality measures around. I mentioned the long-stay, short-stay measures. If you're not familiar with them, you will be soon. And then there's some really interesting ones that are coming off. Many of you have voluntarily started submitting payroll data to CMS, the payroll-based journals, on your staffing. Everybody now should be doing that. And we should see the first round of data. It's projected to be sometime around January that we should see something. Whether they actually meet that deadline or not, I don't know. I have no idea how much adjustments they're having to make, how that data looks. But that potentially has some really good data to include in a possible quality measures at some point in the future. Now, because I had access to some of the additional data that a lot of folks didn't, we really wanted to see, without having right now a good definition of what quality is, let's look at what CMS is looking for some of the quality measures and see if what we have available, five-star, Gold Seal, has any relationship. So do facilities that have a high star rating, do they perform better in what I might classify as more health outcomes measures? So again, using the MDS data, we created variables reflecting the percentage of individuals in a facility, Medicaid recipients, who had X, Y, or Z. So the flu vaccine, this is something that you've been measuring for a while. And this, so full disclosure, this is just a simple correlation. There is no advanced statistics behind this. This is whether there's a direct relationship between the two variables, the CMS five-star, and for this first one, the percentage of individuals who had a flu shot. And for the health inspection component of that score, there was some significant relationships. Not very strong. None of these are really strong relationships. So an R value of about 30, 33 is pretty strong when we talk about social research. If you have something in the 60s, it's a really, really strong relationship. Somewhere around 10, 12, not so strong. I wouldn't make policy decisions based on a weak relationship like that. But you can see there's not a lot of relationship between what we might consider as good quality measures or something that might contribute to a quality score, flu vaccines, pneumonia vaccines, major falls, restraints, among some of the big quality measures that we're currently using. Now, again, you can see the overall rating, major falls, an R of negative 0.2 is what you want to see. These are all in the right direction. But the QM rating, the RN staffing, none of those really contribute to understanding what's happening or related to a higher quality score that CMS does. Some of the other measures that CMS is looking at currently that we have data on from the MDS, self-reported severe pain, and I looked at this one both ways. So the measure that CMS looks at is a moderate to severe pain. The MDS actually has severe pain and then horrible pain. So I looked at both of those individually just to see whether there was some relationship between the five-star quality ratings and these measures. And the only one that there was a relationship between, and again, very weak relationship, but a relationship nonetheless, is horrible pain. A few more, depression, self-reported depression, staff depression, antipsychotic use, and then I created a summary score just because I thought it would be interesting to look at, just to see if there are some, again, what relationships are there. Is anything strong? We want to hang our hat on the five-star as our quality measure, or even components of the five-star. And just looking at these basic correlations, I don't think that it captures what we might be interested as a state to incentivizing. I think most folks would reflect that some of these measures here are things that are really important to quality of life for individuals. Horrible pain, and we had where am I at? I have one on here as well. Urinary tract infections is another one that CMS is monitoring. Again, really no relationships there. So with that being said, looking across the literature, looking across what's happening across the states, what CMS is doing currently with the quality measures don't really seem to be things that are related or associated with better health, better outcomes for the resident-specific measures. So I would maybe ask that, as a group, as your organizations reflect on this, what are some good outcomes that we'd want to include in a quality measure? What are some things that are really important that have a big impact on the quality of life for individuals? Because we don't want to have 12 different measures in a quality component, because it's very hard to drive overall quality when you have 12 different things you're trying to do at the same time. What are those factors that are likely to have the biggest impact on, downstream quality of life, resident satisfaction for you, and what we can capture with what already exists? Because that's a big piece that we're trying to do, is let's not create anything new. If we have information and data that's good, let's use the data that's available. Maybe use it differently than we've traditionally used it, because we've never used MDS to drive quality. We've never used some of the other measures that feed into the five-star to drive quality. We've got some really good feedback so far from different groups and different individuals. I'd love to hear, and I saw some of the other payment methodologies by different groups that have some of these in there that I looked at. Gold seal, we looked at that as well. This is the components that go into a gold seal. There was really one significant relationship between gold seal and all those measures that I mentioned. It was a reduction in UTIs, urinary tract infections. All right, you can do. Provided here is just more just basic information to kind of illustrate what's going on across the state. If you're curious, and then making comparisons to the United States and the ranking and where Florida sits with other states with infection control. And I'm trying to figure out where my glasses are to read something that small. I just got new glasses with different lens sizes in it. Accident environment, food sanitation, quality of care, comprehensive care plans, unnecessary drugs, qualified personnel. And you can see, we have some areas in these that, some of them were above national standards, some of them were below the national averages. So potentially something that might be included or we might recommend to be as part of a quality measure. And then we mentioned this in the past, different ways that quality could be done, or a quality component. And again, not necessarily we're looking at this, but this is how other states have done it. They create project-based incentives, so grants for modernization, grants for equipment, grants for improvements in facilities for quality of life. Rebalancing, similar to how MCOs are incentivized to move individuals from institutions into the community. And then I think, yeah, this is just about the end. So we're looking at quality heavily right now. We're getting a lot more data. We still have a couple data points that we're bringing into our models, bringing into the information we have available that will provide some of this integrated into the facility where a facility sits, so we're able to understand it a little bit better. But the questions that we have that, you know, we're soliciting feedback is, which measures do we believe are valuable? Which of those measures? Now, it's hard to say that none of those aren't valuable measures, but which ones are important to include in a model? Do we use the 5-star, the governor's gold seal, as a portion of that measure? Recognizing that, at least on some of these outcomes, some of these measures, there's very little relationship between the two. Do we develop any state-specific measures? So 5-star doesn't seem to be working, at least for those 8 to 10 variables that I referenced. Are there pieces of it that we want to use and build something new that's Florida-specific? And then, again, still to be determined to some extent, is what percent of the overall reimbursement will be earmarked for quality incentives? All right. And I think we can open up for questions or comments.
Yeah, so you see that last slide up there. If you guys have any additional, you know, as you leave this meeting, additional information you want to submit to us, feel free to do so. You're more than welcome to do that. If anyone would like to have additional stakeholder meetings with us, we've been doing that through this process. Again, feel free to reach out to us. We are definitely open to do that. So right now, if there's any additional questions based off this second part, I'd like to go ahead and open it up for the folks here in the audience first. And I see a few hands, so go over to them.
Doug Burr from Healthcare Navigator again. One other thing that I noticed as you were going through the slide presentation is there seemed to be some differences between the slide presentation in the room and the one that was on the website that we got before we came in. And particularly I noticed it on slide 26 with respect to some of the preliminary decisions that you'd made, specifically the one about the decision on a transition time period. And I'm wondering, are you going to be uploading the version of the PowerPoint presentation to the website?
Yes. So the version you see on the board or on the screen today is the final version. The version that was sent out there were some corrections that needed to be made to that. So disregard the earlier version.
The second question or comment that I had is related to the peer grouping for bed size of facilities, and I'd encourage you to continue digging in on that information and possibly looking at maybe a different cut point for the number of beds for large and small, because statistically I really do believe that there is a point at which you lose the ability to allocate a lot of those fixed overhead costs over the volume. And that really becomes problematic for smaller facilities to lose that efficiency, and they have no other way to gain that efficiency back other than to have their own separate peer group to make an adjustment for that. It may not make a big difference in a peer group like a direct care, where so much of your cost is truly variable based mm-hmm. upon volume of census, but in some of the other cost centers where it's not, where it's truly a fixed cost or a stepped fixed cost, where you don't make a change in the staffing of your administrative component unless you have a significant change in your operation.
Yeah,
and I would say intuitively we would agree that that's what we would expect to see, just like we would expect to see variation in direct care costs with differences in case mix. But we can go back and take a look at that some more and keep our eye to that, but it's because the result is a little puzzling, but it's what we see. So
yeah, and
we'll continue looking at it.
Yeah, and Doug, I will say that I looked at bed size in several different ways. The relationship is there when you look at the variable as a linear variable or as continuous. But as soon as you start breaking it into subgroups, 0 to 100, 101 to 200, you lose that level of detail. So there seems to be a relationship. If you have some recommendations on what might be good groupings, I'm open to it, but looking at it as 0 to 100 and compared to the other three groups that I had set up, there were really no statistical differences in cost.
Are there natural volumes of facilities? Take the 650-some-odd facilities and see how many 60 beds, 120 beds there are in the state and see if there's a natural cut point anywhere along that continuum.
Yeah, good suggestion. We can look at some natural breaks in the data. Yeah, okay.
Sheila Forbes with Summit Care. I have a question regarding the acuity and how we will possibly change maybe the payment level with PPS with Medicare. As you know, we have on the 5, 14, 30, 60, and 90-day assessment. With Medicaid, we do their admission, their quarterly, annual, and SIG change as needed. So will we look at changing the schedule for the MDS to fit that, and if so, how would we do it? And if not, how will that figure in on somebody that has one of the acuity measures that we're looking at?
Yeah, so I think when you look at our the preliminary recommendation so far, we're leaning toward not adjusting for acuity, so that may not be an issue. And I'll add that if that comes back into play, we would have to specify which assessment is going to be used to adjust. We would have to decide if that's going to be a snapshot or if that's going to be a weighted over a period of time. There are a lot of questions that would have to be answered about that. But at this point, when we look at us in the data we've looked at so far as a snapshot, one assessment per individual, when we look at that, we're not seeing a compelling reason to make an adjustment based on the RUGs at least. But we may still want to make some adjustments for things like ventilator care, high behavioral issues, things of that nature. So,
go ahead, Erwin.
Okay, thank you. Erwin Bodo, Leading Gage, Florida. Just have a request. I'd like to ask if you would rerun the regression, dropping case mix odds from the input factors. Given that one of the tentative decisions is not to use case mix, I'd like to see how things will drop out after that. Thank you.
Regarding staff turnover, have you considered, in addition to raw turnover, looking at the issues of staff stability, since there's a great deal of literature about maintaining a core level of stable staff to feed the culture of a long-term care community?
So as I understand it, and I haven't seen the data yet, that will be part of what CMS is looking at that will inform the five-star rating going forward, but also should create some data that would be potentially available to us in the future to look at not only turnover but retention and longevity. But with the information we have available right now, we don't have that level of detail. It's strictly staffing hours is what CMS looks at, and it's really what we have available currently.
And a quick comment. The issue of correlation of outcome and proxy indicators, the stuff that we have easily available tend to be clinical kinds of things. How many flu shots did you give? If I'm going to ask you to judge your quality of life, whether or not you've gotten a flu shot this year, unless you happen to get the flu, it's not going to factor as a large consideration. We don't have the kind of data that really determines the quality of life in long-term care, and the outcome in long-term care is quality of life. The outcome is not a flu shot, and the outcome is not a pneumonia vaccine, and the outcome is not the avoidance of a UTI, although if you get it, it's lousy. The outcome is quality of life. In your life, we would say, so do you feel you have choices? Okay? Now, we don't capture that really. I mean, we do in some other issues, but we don't have the metric to play with that. So one of the reasons, I believe, that we're not getting strong values is we're not haven't asked the right questions, although it may indeed be that the facilities that cross their T's and dot their I's on this other stuff also tend to care about the residents' quality of living. It may be, but we don't know how we can exactly correlate those things.
Go ahead, Doug.
And I'll add to the last comment in terms of quality of living. That's a significant piece, but in long-term care, there is obviously also a significant piece relative to chronic conditions, and that's specifically related to trying to find measures that capture the ability to slow down the deterioration caused by chronic conditions or the avoidance of what might have become an acute episode. Things like the functional measures that are captured on the MDS and looking at long stay outcomes from those functional measure scores and the therapy being involved, especially particularly maybe on the Part B side. So I don't know if you've got access to Medicare's Part B claims database to be able to link that up as maybe another source to look at who are the Medicaid patients getting therapy as opposed to the way you've gone and looked at it so far. My guess is that there's probably a greater percentage of Medicaid patients getting access to therapy. You look at the GMO settlement recently in terms of keeping people at a functional level where they are. That's an important factor in addition to just the quality of life.
So staying on that train of thought for a second, if we're looking at, let's say, maintenance or reduced deterioration of ADLs, would that be an appropriate measure? And then if so, what time frame would you look at?
Perhaps, but I'd want to go back to the clinicians to help me with that definition.
Yeah.
Okay, any other questions here in the room? All right, operator, let's see if there's any questions online, please. Operator, are you around? Guess not. Interesting. All right. Okay, well, let's just move forward with the public comment. I did, you know, when you guys signed in, you indicated if you had anything to ask or just to make comment on. So I'll go down that list, and then we'll just go in that order. And if you still wish to speak, you're more than welcome to. If not, then we can go on to the next. And if there's anyone who did not wish to speak or a right to wish to speak and wants to, you're more than welcome to do so. So the first on the list is Akedra Bonamy. You got a microphone? One second. And if you could state your name and who you're with, I appreciate that.
Okay. My name is Kedra Bonamy. I'm a CNA, and I'm with 1199 SEIU. I'm from Orlando. Long-term care is where I work. I want to sincerely thank you for the opportunity to express my story. I wanted to talk about the points of quality care today. I've been a CNA for 12 years. I became a CNA. I wasn't going to get emotional. I wanted to get my story out. When my mom passed, it made me become a CNA because the things that were going on with my mom, the basic things I did not know, which could have been maybe avoided. I went into CNA school, got in there, been in there ever since. A great time of me being a CNA. I've worked two full-time jobs. I have no children, but I worked two full-time jobs. When I first became a CNA, I can remember being so happy and excited. I can remember having my clothes ironed up for 2 weeks straight. Over the years of becoming a CNA, It's like I almost have to push myself to go. A lot of that is different things with just being fatigued and tired, just extremely tired. The workplace have changed so much as far as quality care. I can remember a time when we had more time with patients. I can remember when we could hold their hands, we could massage them, we could sit with them sometimes and have that relationship with them. Now it's almost like you wash them, you change their sheets, you position them to make sure they're comfortable and you keep it moving. It's just so much, to me, I don't feel like it's quality. We're having more patients now. And with having more patients, how can you really go back and turn them every 2 hours, or some of them need to be turned even more than that, maybe every hour? It's impossible. Benefits. A lot of people that are CNAs, we work two jobs and can't even afford insurance. We use natural remedies to take care of ourselves, legs and backs and shoulders and different stuff. We bring the rub on each other. And it's sad. Basically, the wages, the poverty wages, is awful as being a CNA. As a CNA, we give direct care more so than anybody in a facility. In a facility, we're with them. We're their eyes. We're their ears. We're everything for them. We're the hugs when their family members don't even come to see them. We bring clothes for them, for those that who don't have clothes. And we give our hearts as CNA. We hold a lot of responsibility as CNAs, and we are the ones that's the most stepped on. So now in talking about the quality of care, a lot of the patients that are coming in are either mental health or bariatric. A lot of the bariatric patients that we have, it takes two or three CNAs to take care of them. If two or three CNAs is in there with one in particular patient, there's only six CNAs on the floor. Most of the patients that we're getting is two to three CNAs to take care of them. If four or five lights on, who's answering them? If the nurses are passing meds and their ratio is ridiculous also, who's responsible for the lights? Miss so-and-so want to go to the bathroom. Her daughter is there. She feels this one needs to be turned. This one now needs to be changed, but you got three CNAs in there with a bariatric patient. I just think the ratio should be a little bit better. A lot of times we as CNAs, we're demanded by management to get off the clock on time, not 1 minute after. It's a write-up and all this different stuff. A lot of times we clock out and we continue to do care to our patients to make sure that they are okay before we go home and we go to sleep at night, to make sure we have given them love in my facility that we don't say we're giving care. I'm going to give my patients some love, is what we say. And I just thank you guys for listening to my story as a CNA and take it into consideration.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments there. Okay, next on the list, Erwin, I believe you have some comments you'd like to make.
Thank you. My name is Irvin Bodo, Leading Gage, Florida. I have submitted to the agency the written version of the comments, and I'm not going to go through line by line given that my teleprompter is not working this morning. So please bear with me. We appreciate the opportunity to comment. We very much appreciate the work that Navigant has done to this point, preparing the document that we see on the web this morning, and of course in previous work that has already been distributed. We have a task force at Leading Edge that put together our guiding principles, and not surprisingly perhaps that our guiding principles pretty much match up with the AHCA's guiding principles that are stated by Navigant in their paper. The quality, access, feasibility of easy implementation, and equitability, and those are the type of things we can probably all agree if we're only talking about concept. The implementation is what makes it much more difficult. We have done a significant amount of statistical work, and we believe that the more factors, and as you call them, Jay, cost drivers, you include, the more likely we'll be able to get closer to what the actual current costs are. we have to somehow believe that those facilities that are currently losing dollars on Medicaid because their staffing is high or because their cost is high for not just staffing but other reasons, they are not doing these extra costs just for nothing. That clearly is something that's driving them. Generally speaking, at least listening to our members at Leading Edge, it's the quality that they are wishing to impart on their residents, making sure they have the best possible life, not just quality of care, but quality of life. So we'd like to suggest to the greatest extent possible that you all look at quality measures carefully and do include them. I believe that if you rerun the regression that I've asked a couple minutes earlier to do, you will see that some of the quality indicators will show up significantly. Clearly, staffing will show up significantly as part of the overall drive. So let me get in a little bit more about specifics. First, what we'd like to recommend is that as you look at budget neutrality, you segregate property and all other costs into two components. We'd like to keep those two separate parts. We don't want to take money from the property component and put it into the other three. And similarly, we don't want to take any money away from care and put it into a property component. We believe that the property component itself right now is deficient. There's no reason to take any more money and put it anywhere else. And I think vice versa with the other component. I apologize, but I didn't memorize the whole thing, so I'm going to have to look through it. But as we go forward, we have essentially started out with the existing six classes. We did not try to judge or measure whether or not the six classes are appropriate or not. Clearly, your work indicates that there may be some questionable decisions on that, whether or not we go with size, since you couldn't find the difference, and whether or not the geographic regions as we have right now are appropriate. We have no quibble with that. Whatever the data finds is fine. We just ended up using the six for convenience. We didn't have access for case mix data, therefore none of our analysis used any of that information. We used a proxy for the overall quality score for the CMS nursing home compare. We did find significant relationships between quality and the costs, and we're looking at actual reported and perhaps in that some cases, if audit was already done, adjusted cost as that's being used for rate setting for the September 1, 2016 rate setting period. We have two adjustment factors. One of them is based on the quality. That's a factor that essentially makes both positive and negative adjustments in the maximum amount of 10% of the rate. The second adjustment is only in a positive area, and it rewards staffing over and above the minimum. We assume that 3.6, even though that's a statutory minimum, is not achievable on a long-term basis. You actually have to have a higher staffing, and we pick 3.7. I don't know if that's reasonable or not, but it has to be somewhat higher than 3.6 in order to meet the 3.6 on every single day. Those adjustments, the second one related to staffing, is a positive only, meaning we reward facilities with high staffing. We base that decision on existing literature that clearly demonstrates there's a positive relationship between the number of direct care staffing, nurse as well as CNA, but especially nurse, and the quality of life and quality of care. The previous speaker very nicely illustrated how some of those things are important, not just to the residents, but also to the workers. We also made one final adjustment, which we called price corridors. We'd like to think that the less we disturb the current system in a drastic way, the better we're off. We think the current system, by and far, pretty much meets the established goals that AHCA had set to begin with. I think we have pretty reasonable access. It's a reasonable, simple calculations. Predictability may not be quite as good as you guys would like to have it, but again, it's mostly the caseload rather than the actual pricing model. So we think the current system is reasonably good. We'd like to ask that as we go forward, because we cannot have all the cost drivers accurately predicting what cost should be, don't ignore, in whatever model you develop, the current structure and the current prices, i.e. rates, that are being used. And that's all we have. Thank you very much for your time.
All right. Thank you for those comments. Next, we have Jose Suarez. Do you like to make any comments?
Thank you again. My name is Jose Suarez. I'm here representing 1199 SEIU Florida. We are the largest union organization of healthcare workers in the state of Florida. We represent 10,000 nursing home workers at 80 skilled nursing facilities throughout the state, like Cadre and Rochelle. We also hold the distinct honor of representing an additional 10,000 retired members statewide, many of whom are frequent consumers of long-term care services. We applaud the efforts to modernize and streamline Florida's nursing home payment system. We appreciate the guiding principles of the initial report and this process, which call us to strive to achieve maximum predictability, equity, access, and quality in whatever final product we propose. We rise today to focus your attention on one of those guiding principles and our urgent need to ensure that we create a system that delivers the highest quality standard of care possible. First, we cannot address quality care without taking the labor cost differential into consideration. There is a direct correlation between the quality of care our system delivers and the wages and benefits of those providing the care. Besides the moral imperative of providing a high level of care to our state's most vulnerable, Florida has an economic incentive to ensure that our state becomes the standard bearer for delivering quality long-term care services. In 2015, FSU professor Patrick Mason found that low wages cost Florida taxpayers $11.4 billion in corporate subsidies annually. We urge you to consider ways to incentivize nursing homes to earn additional reimbursements for improving wages and benefits. We have a choice. We can continue to allow our safety net to make up for the failure of for-profit entities, or we can incentivize work by encouraging for-profit service providers to pay a living wage. Second, we support the quality incentive payments that are multifaceted and are not just solely based on resident outcomes, but also include measures around staff retention, staff turnover, and staffing levels. We encourage you to look at value-based purchasing programs like those in Minnesota, Kansas, Ohio, Iowa, Georgia, and Oklahoma. We encourage incentivizing quality achievement and improvement with a quality incentive payment that also rewards providers who meet minimum staffing standards. Third, we call on you to fully restore the promise of 2.9 hours of daily care for nursing home residents. Total CNA bedside care was rolled back from 2.9 hours of care to 2.5 of care, with RN LPN care remaining consistent at 1 hour of care. It might not seem like a big deal, but the bulk of the bedside care in a nursing home is delivered by certified nursing assistants. The loss of 0.4 hours of care per day is a difference between a loved one getting a hot bath or not, missing a meal or not, and getting the medications they need on time. Lastly, we urge you to avoid adopting a new fair rental value system model that increases the capital cost component to the detriment of key reimbursement categories like direct resident care and indirect resident care. We urge you to consider looking at other FRVS models like that of California. California aggregates a growth cap of 8% on FRVS costs compared to the previous year. This would serve to keep costs down, increase predictability, and allow us to prioritize quality standards like those we've put forward that would increase quality for residents and standards for caregivers. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Okay, next we have Steve. No, okay. All right. Deborah Franklin.
Good afternoon. My name is Deborah Franklin, and I'm the Director of Operations for a not-for-profit company. We operate the entire continuum across Florida. I'm also the chairperson of Florida Healthcare Association's Prospective Payment Task Force. This task force is made up of I'm going to brag a little bit here, but a brain trust that I'm very proud of. It is clinicians that represent quality across the nation. They've been involved in a lot of research projects. It's also some of the top reimbursement specialists that work here in Florida and also with companies that represent national facilities, so that we've brought a lot of experience to the table. So Florida Healthcare appreciates the opportunity to provide continuing input on the development of this prospective payment system. We recognize how important it is for Florida, for Florida's elderly, for Florida's caregivers, that we do this right. So thank you for all everyone that's taken the time and research to do that. Florida Healthcare is the largest and leading association representing long-term care providers and the residents they care for. Of Florida's 688 nursing centers, Florida Healthcare represents 559, that's 81% of the centers here in Florida. This includes not-for-profits, independently owned, multi-facility groups, and government-operated centers. As you're aware, Florida Healthcare supports the movement to a prospective payment system for the same reasons that Navigant has laid out here on page 4 of their report. Quality, access, equity, predictability, and simplicity in our lives of non-simple regulations that we have to accommodate. We thank the agency and Navigant for the open communication that is occurring as we move through this process. Enclosed in my testimony, you will have a one-page sheet that kind of breaks out our proposal a little more detailed than what I'm going to go through here now. Florida Healthcare created the PPS Task Force to develop input for Navigant and the agency as it develops a PPS recommendation for the legislature. During the June 30th meeting, Navigant proposed a series of questions for consideration. At this point, Florida Healthcare Association has focused on a few key areas, which I will address today. Should there be a fair rental value system for capital, and what should it look like? Nursing centers must continually update to keep pace with the changing demographics of our customers. The baby boomers are arriving, replacing the greatest generation members as our primary customers. They come to us with very different expectations and needs. The average Florida nursing center was built more than 35 years ago. We must upgrade technologies and modernize our centers to meet those expectations. To that end, Florida Healthcare Association fully supports a fair rental value system which incentivizes renovations and enhancements. We have shared data with you, and we will continue to work with you on developing a framework for FRBS. Next question, should there be a quality incentive component? Any plan moving forward must incentivize and reward nursing centers for providing quality of care to our frail elderly seniors. Florida Healthcare strongly supports a quality component included in the PPS methodology and recommends a model attached to my testimony. The model contains four domains with multiple measures within each domain. All measures are threshold-based, so all providers have the potential to exceed the quality threshold. 12 measured elements, and thus a total of 12 points are possible. In order to qualify for a prospective quality incentive payment, each provider would have to earn at least 1 point in every domain for the preceding year. Providers that achieve certain distinctions, such as Baldrige Criteria-Based National Quality Silver and Gold Award JACO accreditation or the governor's gold seal would automatically be awarded 1 point in each of those four domains. The amount of money to assign to the quality incentive payment pool is still to be decided. Any funds remaining in the quality incentive payment pool as a result of some providers not meeting the quality incentive program eligibility level would be distributed as year-end true-up payments amongst qualified providers. The four domains are as follow. One, workforce. You just heard some wonderful testimony about how important our workforce is. Number two is outcomes. We want to make sure what we're doing, the outcomes match. The system's working. It's not unintended outcomes, but it's good outcomes. Number three, quality measures. These are long-stay measures. This product, Medicaid, is mostly long-stay patients, so our measures are looking at long-stay measures. And four, the most important part of quality is to measure what we're doing, customer satisfaction. Next question. Should there be a transition or phase-in period? What should the time frame be for the phase-in? Very important that we think very heavily about this because we have frail elderly in our nursing centers, and we can't make a mistake and cause them to suffer. There will be funding shifts among providers with the implementation of any new system, and it is important for providers and their residents to allow them to adjust their care and business models to reflect new reimbursements. Florida Healthcare Association supports a multi-year transition period with additional non-recurring funds for providers who will have lower rates to transition them over this period. In closing, Florida Healthcare Association thanks you for the opportunity to present today. We look forward to working with you on creating a new payment system for Florida's Medicaid nursing center care.
Thank you for those comments. All right, Clint Shue.
Thank you. I'm Clint Shue with BayCare Health System. BayCare actually, in addition to being a large hospital, a large not-for-profit hospital system, has two skilled nursing facilities, one rehab facility that's a member of the Florida Healthcare Association and one CCRC that's a member of Leading Age. And so we're very confident in the ability of those two associations to represent our interests well. What I really wanted to focus on is the issue of access for ventilator patients and ventilator-dependent patients in specifically. I was curious for Navigant, when you were doing your analysis, how many vent-dependent patients, were you able to detect the number of vent-dependent patients that have been in the system, in the skilled nursing facility system?
There weren't a lot. The records that we had that had identified somebody who was specifically vent-dependent was about 571, roughly about 500 records.
Over 1 year or multi-year?
At a snapshot.
Okay.
Yeah.
From our perspective, one of the major challenges from a hospital perspective is finding a place to safely discharge vent-dependent Medicaid patients within the state of Florida. And I know this is an issue that the agency has looked at for 20 years plus, and the legislature has considered long before that. But we would highly encourage the agency to look at this as we're going about the process of updating or transitioning the PPS system to allow for a vent-dependent add-on. If you're not going to do it, obviously, if you're not going to have a broader acuity, then you have to have a special either additional payment or some sort of acuity adjuster. The good thing is, from our perspective, we're not talking about a huge number of patients that are really stuck in a hospital, unable to get into a Medicaid, unable to get into a skilled nursing facility. We tried to look at our numbers, and there were a handful of patients that had long stays in the hospital, but for those patients, we're talking over 100 days for those patients in the hospital. And the outcomes end up being where they end up sometimes having to relocate out of state because we cannot find a location. And so, yes, it's a cost for the hospital that's unnecessary. It's a cost for the insurance companies or for the Medicaid managed care companies that are paying outlier payments unnecessarily. But more so and more concerning, it's a huge impact on those patient families who oftentimes have their relatives relocated hundreds, if not thousands, of miles away from their home because there's no access or very limited access here in the state of Florida. I do think it's important to say that rates for Medicaid across the board, especially here in the skilled nursing world, are tight as is. And so I would not ask for you to pull money away from the existing rate structure, but look for either new revenues or new opportunities to reallocate existing spend for this purpose. So I mentioned the Medicaid outlier payments, for example. Those would seem to be good opportunities where their resources are already being spent to care for these patients in a more cost-intensive environment to reallocate those resources to put them in a skilled nursing area. And this isn't a new concept. Other states do this. Georgia does it. I believe New York does it. And it seems to be that the financial incentive is the core solution that needs to be reached. So I don't know what that number is. Obviously, I know that that the folks at Navigant have a great expertise in dealing with this. Final piece I would mention is I mentioned the revenue neutral component. I understand that limits the agency's perspective and what goes back to the legislature. I would highly recommend, even if you weren't able to allocate the resources within the existing system, coming up with a model that could be presented to the legislature through this process would be a valuable use of time. For example, maybe there's a way to focus on how we can incentivize nursing facilities to help wean Medicaid patients off ventilator systems as part of the payment structure, and other quality incentives that could be built into this that would make it a more attractive option both for the legislature as well as for, most importantly, the skilled nursing facilities that would have to step up and take on that level of care. So that's just what I wanted to say. Appreciate it.
Thank you for those comments. Next we have Elliot Paluski.
I'm Elliot Paluski with the River Garden Hebrew Home in Jacksonville, Florida, and part of the Leading Age PPS Task Force. Would like to thank the CNA who spoke and would appeal to the task force to be careful in how the system is modeled as it is projected to behave over time, so that those of us who do recognize the importance of CNAs and pay living wages and benefits and provide the time for the hand-holding and the talking and the massaging aren't forced to level down to a less quality of living median, but are allowed to continue to provide the kind of quality of living care communities that many of us strive to operate. The amount of work that CNAs do is incalculable, but more important than any particular task is the nature of the relationship that they form with the residents for whom they care. And that is also true on the part of the nursing staff and social workers and activity workers. Long-term care is a relational system. It's not an industrial system. And for that reason, yes, phasing in whatever changes are going to be have to be gradual so that the rug isn't pulled out from under those relationships. The system that will be proposed needs to encourage folks to strive for better, not to see how low they can go in order to reap some kind of retained revenue. When we began the current system, which is now under review, years and years ago, the rate for long-term care was set by choosing the median, arraying all the providers and coming up with the median. And this is 30-some-odd years ago. And as we examined that in dealing with the department and the legislature, it turned out that the facilities that set the median were chronically underperforming facilities. At no point was it the intent to encourage chronically underperforming facilities, but that is how it behaved dynamically, and that's how it resulted. And so as we do this, when you show the distribution of costs, whatever quality measure we begin to look at, and those are tough, and as we mentioned, those are tough, we can't force everyone on the higher cost side into the middle and thus make it impossible to strive for better. We shouldn't be rewarding the folks on the lower cost side if their outcomes don't show that it's a result of efficiency. We need a dynamic system which allows for the constant rewarding of quality improvement. The question of using available data in order to come at that is really nettlesome, because the kind of data that we have available really is based upon clinical indicators, and those clinical indicators aren't necessarily correlated with the resident experience. But the totality of those indicators over time, along with the health inspection reports over time, tend to point to which providers afford their residents a quality of living experience. So it's not any one particular indicator that correlates, but over time, the totality of the health inspection stuff, over time, the totality of the staff retention stuff, over time, the totality of the meeting certain kinds of benchmarks, whether it's vaccines or avoidance of infection, when we put all that stuff together and then do it over time, we begin to approach the kind of provider that is attempting to continuously improve. And that's a very tall task to ask very sincere people to take into account. But we certainly don't want to move towards a system which rewards by retained revenue underperformance and which forces excellence to move towards the median because we're roundheads leveling. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Next, Jenny George.
I just wanted to follow up with one point. Just when we were talking about looking for the most appropriate or the best quality measures to look at, and I know we've already talked about bed size, but before a decision is made, and I understand that you looked at bed size and you didn't see a correlation, but maybe we were looking at bed size in regards to the entire quality measures totaled together. But when we look at the quality measures and if we drill them down, for instance, the example that was used was pain. You know, I can just give a quick example of my own community. I have a small facility. It's 60 beds, but we don't run 60 beds because of your ins and outs and your post-acute. So it's really more typically 50 beds. So about half of that 100 beds that we were talking about from a small size facility. It's a big difference for me. But with the pain quality measure, it's a self-reported resident measure, and many times it's hard for residents to remember, in the past 7 days did you experience moderate to severe pain. There have been, in our experience, some people that are just truly well managed with their pain, but they will always answer that question that they have had that because there is a sincere fear that they won't continue to receive their pain medications, or they are more drug seekers, which is something we're seeing more and more of. So when we're looking at those quality measures, and those are a couple of examples that I just absolutely had no control over. As much as we work with psychologists and others to try to help this person, if some of my revenue had been based upon that, it would be very challenging for me because there was nothing I could do. I have to answer what the resident reported. So when it is a small facility and I only have a smaller denominator of residents, it does make a big difference in those smaller facilities with certain of those quality measures. So if that can still be considered, thank you.
And just for clarification, we didn't look at facility size as it related to quality. We just looked at the relationship between the quality measures that we had available and some of those bigger MDS quality. We didn't control for facility size at all. It was just a simple correlation.
Okay, thank you for those comments. And then next on the list is Rochelle.
Hello. Hi, I'm Rochelle Salcedo. I'm also a certified nursing assistant. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity that I'm able to give you my testimony as a CNA. I've been a CNA for 15 years. Just like Kadra said, used to be before, it was fun to work. I also want to give you a feedback in regards to me, for me, why I wanted to be a CNA and why I became a CNA. Is that because of my grandmother. This is back home in the Philippines that we keep our own. We took care of my grandma, and I was still young at that time. And we gave her this thing that we call quality of care and quality of life. What frustrates me so much is that this time it became all about money. The quality of care, being a CNA, is cut in a way that we do our best to care for our patients, but the thing what we can do is that we can only do much. Right now, we have a lot of patients, we have more patients, and then less CNAs, and then more demands from the management. And then, in addition to that, it's like decrease of hours from the eight hours that we used to work, now it was decreased to 7.5. So, in regards to this, this is my personal thing that I want to testify to you, is that for me to be able to care for all my residents, I have to sacrifice my 30 minutes. If I was able to sacrifice my 30 minutes when I used to work 8 hours before, now it was decreased to 7.5. Literally, I can't do the 7.5. That's what I told my administrator. The problem with, just like the ratio we have right now is 2.5. We cut into 2.5 before it was 2.9. 2.9, we have more CNAs, less residents. Now we have less CNAs, more residents or patients, and more demands. In regards to elderly people, when you're dealing with elderly people, you just have to imagine this. We don't even have to imagine this because we see it day by day. You cannot rush them when you're giving care to them. The 15 minutes that the state regulates, it doesn't work. Because for me, it's 25 to 30 minutes, and also case-to-case basis. It depends on the demands of a patient. It depends on what needs the patient has. And most of the time, the patient need two CNAs to care for that patient, or three CNAs. So what happened to the rest of the patients that we have to care? So it's affecting our work. But what really breaks my heart, it's affecting the resident and patients I have. It breaks my heart because I cannot give the real care I wanted to give to them. That used to be four. When we used to have a 2.9, we have less residents. I have time to talk to my patients. I have time to walk them around the building. Now, because I have more residents, I cannot even do that. Just like the other day when a resident asked me, "Do you have a minute? I just want to talk to you. I have to finish my work." I told my patient, "Can you give me just a few minutes? I'll be back with you." But that few minutes is not even few minutes because it became hours. So it's heartbreaking that the CNAs has to go through a lot of these things, that just like the living wage that we have right now, it's not even a living wage. The hours that we have to work from 8 hours cut to 7.5, the benefits that we're supposed to have, we don't even have it, that because most of the CNAs I work with don't even have insurance, health insurance, and they have to work two jobs, three jobs. And as you know, that elderly people, they decline. Their health declines. So the more they decline, the more help they need. So in my heart, I urge you to consider to bring back that 2.9, please.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate those comments. Thank you. Okay, that was all that we had on the list who had signed up to speak. Is there anyone else in here that would like to make any additional comments? Okay, not seeing any. I guess we can try to see if the operator's around to see if anyone can turn on the phone.
Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, to ask an audio question or to make a comment, please press star 1 followed by the pound key. Please press star 1 to begin. There are no audio questions queued up at this time.
Okay, thank you, operator, for checking on that. All right, well, that's all that we had for today. As you can see up on the screen, we do have we will have another public meeting scheduled for September 20th, and then we will get that information out and post it to our website. And if you guys are signed up for the provider alerts, or if you aren't, that would probably be good if you do that on the agency's website. You can go out there and sign up for the provider alerts, because we do put out an alert every time that we will have a public meeting, so everyone can know that. So with that, I think we'll go ahead and close the meeting for today. Appreciate you guys coming in attendance and those on the phone, and we look forward to seeing you next time.